I'd like to welcome Christopher Trumbo. He is the writer of the play Trumbo, and the film by the same name is screening at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Your father, Dalton Trumbo, was an extremely successful writer, above all screenwriter, and then he was blacklisted and, in fact, was one of the Hollywood 10, which included some of the greatest talent in Hollywood. What, in your father's case, was his supposed crime? Was it simply affiliation with communism, or was it the power of the ideas expressed in his films?
Well, his what he was convicted of was contempt of Congress. And what he refused to do was answer the questions of Congress in areas that he thought were none of Congress's business, which was freedom of association. And he certainly wasn't alone in that. And communism is not the only ideology or reason for not answering Congress's questions about that sort of thing. Linus Pauling, who was a double Nobel Prize winner, also refused to answer those questions.
The witch hunt that was associated with communism hit so many artists. There was a scholar who is shown in the film, a scholar of your father's work, who speaks of writers like Trumbo who were shifting the archetypes that were dominant in films of the time. Can you say more about this? What's an example of that from your father's work?
Well, I don't know, because I don't happen to agree with that assessment.
Interesting.
I can't think of an archetype that was shifted, by these people as a group. What I do think is that as motion pictures matured as an art form, they became concerned with areas rather than just trying to get a laugh or trying to shock an audience into more and more human stories. And there are some people who are more adept at writing that kind of story than others. And I think it was really the development of a medium. And the fact that these people tended to be interested, who were blacklisted, tended to be interested in social issues, although they were far from the only people in Hollywood who were.
Now, your father was actually jailed for, I think, just under a year during this period. Talk about the kind of support that he got from his friends and colleagues.
First of all, it sort of separated people in terms of who is really your friend and those who are not. It was a difficult choice for many people, because to remain friends or to support him in a public way could endanger their own careers. And there are people who you simply just don't see anymore, because you can understand why. In other words, my father could understand, he can't afford to be seen with me.
I think it takes a great deal of compassion in a certain kind of person to forgive and be understanding under those circumstances, and I think your father was like that.
Well, what he understood, was that not the person, it is the institution, that it is the system that is forcing people to behave in ways that otherwise would not.
So when your father got out of jail, your family moved to Mexico.
Yes.
Do you remember this period? You were a child at that time.
Sure. I was 11 years old when we moved to Mexico.
What was it like there? And what was it like for your father trying to maintain a career as an American blacklisted writer?
Well, that wasn't, it didn't, his plans, never quite worked out. But then what happens also is that the blacklist, what it is and how it works, is constantly changing. So that expectations in 49, are confronted by the reality of 1952, and the two don't agree. So that it was a difficult thing to predict.
Well,
we would have gone to Europe, where things would have been considerably easier in terms of employment, but the State Department refused to issue passports.
So what did he do? I mean, how did he find work?
Well, whatever contacts he had in Hollywood could reach him. And with, for instance, a script called The Brave One, he had the idea for the story. and flew to Los Angeles and made a deal for it, and then went back to Mexico.
That was a period in which a lot of people wrote under pseudonyms, and that was just part of what happened. Your father wasn't the only one. How did that work? There was one film for which his pseudonym received an Academy Award.
Actually, he has two Academy Awards written under other people's names, mm-hmm. but one of them is The Brave One, and the other is Roman Holiday. But there are two ways that the blacklist operates. First, if you have an original piece of material, whether it be a story or a screenplay, it can be sold under somebody else's name. If a producer has a project that they want you to work on, they need to find another person to front for that or, you know, once again, establish a fake identity. The reason that producers are willing to risk hiring blacklisted writers is that they are getting people that they think have talent at a bargain price. The difference in price was approximately 90%.
Good heavens.
So if you have a markdown on, let's say, a mink coat for 90%, you're probably going to think of buying it.
So it was just another kind of labor exploitation.
Yes, in a sense, but it is and it isn't. The black market was the only way to make a living if you wanted to be a writer, once you were blacklisted. So the exploitation is not necessarily the worst aspect of it. The fact that an entire industry has decided to blacklist people, to make them unemployable until they conform to the ideas of what that industry thinks a human being should be, that is the great crime.
We're talking to Christopher Trumbo. It's amazing that there were so many people who were blacklisted and that not only the congressional committees and so on who were behind this, but also so many people in Hollywood actually allowed it to happen. Who are the players who are on the side of the anti-communist movement?
The blacklist is imposed by the studios. The studios will not hire people who are blacklisted under their own names. And generally, blacklisted writers are working for independent producers who manage to get their financing in another way. The studios won't hire, and banks will not loan money if they know that a blacklisted writer is involved. There are ways around it, but obviously they are difficult and are kept secret. The people the individuals who decide that the blacklist or not hiring blacklisted people is important are people like Roy Brewer, who is the president of the IATSE, which is a union in the theatrical industry, and people like Ward Bond, the actor, Adolph Manjou, John Wayne. So there are a number of newspaper columnists like Hedda Hopper. All of these people had a great deal of power in those days, and we can hardly imagine a gossip columnist having that kind of power today. Wait, no, we can. We've got Mr. Drudge. But it is it's a complicated setup, and one that grew rather than one that had fast rules applied to it.
Talk about the way the rules changed.
Well, part of the problem is that the blacklist itself started off with the promise by the studios that only 10 people would be blacklisted and everybody else was safe. That changed. Eventually, there were at least a minimum of 300 people who were formally blacklisted. That also started to apply to people who had not been communists or people who had not appeared before the committee, but who were considered suspects because they belonged, let's say, to wrong organizations, even though they had not been communists. There were people who there were rumors that they might be politically too much to the left. And these people became what was known as gray-listed. And because while they hadn't been named in any formal way, they couldn't get work and they couldn't figure out what it was. And eventually, when they did figure it out, there were ways to get yourself off the gray list or to get yourself employed again. One of those ways was to find, for instance, a powerful patron, a powerful producer or director who insisted upon your work. And that was probably the easiest way of doing it.
What were some other ways?
The other ways are to go before someone like Roy Brewer. And what you then do is say, what do I have to get off the blacklist, the gray list? What do I need to be employed? I've never done anything remotely wrong. And they instruct you on what to do and what to say. Mostly that has to do with saying, well, you know, when I supported that guy over there, you know, when I was against nuclear weapons and with that peace group that seems to be suspect right now, well, I was wrong to do that. And belonging to that group was a stupid thing. So that what happens is that you must, in a sense, reinvent yourself to the script that they have written for you. And this is not just private in a room. This goes out, you know, into the newspapers. It's a public form of humiliation.
And also,
and only having performed that act are you considered trustworthy.
And then if you're a writer or an artist of any kind, then you have to continually engage in a kind of self-censorship.
The self-censorship, as far as movies were concerned, it was, you know, people simply knew what not to write and what wouldn't work. There were certainly, among the other things that people had to do, was work on specifically anti-communist films like My Son John, and there were a variety of films that were deliberately produced by the studios, 50 or 60 of them, I think, that were absolutely propaganda, and I mean that in the sense of a piece of work that is meant to change your opinion or give you an opinion that was anti-communist. None of these pictures made money, but they fulfilled a political need.
What were the films that were making money? Was there, did writers manage to sneak their messages, like your father, who was still writing, even when under pseudonyms, messages of what they believed in into their films during this period?
The problem is that you would have to go back to films that people who were blacklisted had written, and say, look at how un-American that is, or look at how that promotes the communist ideology, or look how that favors socialism, or whatever it is that you think is wrong, and show it as an example. The problem is that it can't be done. The films that have some sympathy for the Soviet Union, for instance, that is expressed in the films, were made during World War II, when the Soviet Union was the ally of the United States against fascism. And those movies were requested to be made by the government. I'm thinking of things like Mission to Moscow, for instance.
So those were real, I mean, in another, real government-sponsored propaganda films?
Yeah, to the extent that the government wants them done. The government is not paying for them. The government actually has, you know, is during Second World War, produces films of all kinds in order to persuade people that, for instance, they shouldn't buy on the, silk stockings on the black market. But these were films that were requested that the motion picture industry make.
We're talking to Christopher Trumbo. So getting back to your father's work during that period, do you feel that he engaged in a kind of self-censorship?
No. The idea that, you know, that if what you want to do as a writer is impose your political ideas in the work, you know, is kind of peculiar. I don't know of, for instance, a motion picture today that is out there, you know, promoting Republicanism or the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. So, you know, stories are stories. Films are films.
I suppose the person's nature and feelings does bleed through. I mean, some of these super
sure.
military
well,
films.
I'll give you an example. the ways that, you know, you would choose to depict a character, for instance. You could have a character who, let's say this is 1944, 1945, who doesn't like black people. And how you are going to portray him may be crucial to your ideas of the way that race should be addressed in a movie. That character could be any number of things. It could be, you know, he could become your hero. And then this quality would be an heroic quality associated with him. You could choose, for instance, to present anyone, as a stereotype. And we have certainly had plenty of those if you watch the movies in the 1930s and early 1940s. So changing those ideas, refusing to say, you know, to use them, saying, I don't believe these things, and these aren't the kind of people I know. Let's do it this way. And you present what you think is a more human view of it.
What was your father's relationship like with other blacklisted Hollywood people during that time that he was in exile and that he was on the blacklist?
There were friends of ours, you know, who were also in Mexico, and other people who came down. And there were also blacklisted writers in Europe, and there were blacklisted writers in Hollywood and New York. And the blacklisted community, they knew each other in one way or another, but they certainly were not organized.
I would imagine that there would be a whole lot of, that there would be at least some conversation and mutual support among them.
Oh, well, sure. The big concern, there are several concerns. One is, what is the policy of Hollywood at this moment? The other question is, how do we get jobs? Do you know anybody who's hiring? In other words, do you know somebody, is there a lead somewhere? And the idea is that, you know, they just have an incredibly difficult time in finding people who are willing to risk hiring them. But they certainly share information.
How long did the Hollywood blacklist go on, and how did it end?
Well, the Hollywood blacklist begins, of course, and is the only thing that we can actually state, you know, as a fact, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, in October or November of 1947. When it stops, we don't know. It does not come to an end in the sense that your car stops and, you know, it's parked. That's not the way it happened. The big breakthrough was probably in 1960, and I would guess by 1967 or 1968, the blacklist was pretty much exhausted.
I mean, I was surprised to find that in 1960 that it was a big deal for your father to have his name credited in the movie Spartacus. I mean, McCarthy was already gone, and yet it was considered a wonderful, amazing thing that he even got the credit on his own film in 1960.
Yes, exactly. And there are people who are still unable to get work under their own names until 5 or 6 or 7 years later. For instance, there is a writer whose name is Michael Wilson. And Michael Wilson, among other things, has screen credit for Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia. And he was unable to get his name back on a film until 1965. So obviously he's a writer who knows what he's doing. But the political opposition is such that he was unable to do them.
So you wrote the one-man play, Trumbo, which has been performed many places by terrific actors, including here in Santa Fe. What led you to bring your father, Dalton Trumbo's life to the stage in this way?
Well, I initially wrote the play as a fundraising device for the installation of a sculpture by Jenny Holzer at the University of Southern California. And by the nature of that, in raising money, you need like a star to be in it, to draw people. And I couldn't think of a way to get people into a theater and ask somebody to memorize a play. So I thought of the idea of letters, and then I decided to tell a story from a particular point of view about the Hollywood blacklist from 1947 to 1960. Now, that doesn't include many other things, but that was the time period I limited myself to, and I decided to tell it through the story of one man and one family. because the focus of it becomes much clearer in that way, and you begin to understand what is a political and social event in a more personal sense.
And so the entire play was based on letters that your father wrote at different times during those years?
Yes.
So all of these letters, you received them, I guess, from their recipients?
No, the letters had actually been published, and that was because he had sent his papers to the University of Wisconsin. And Helen Manful, who was the woman that was in charge of sorting all the papers into various categories, began reading the letters and thought, my goodness, this would make a great book. The play, I think there's only one letter that isn't edited. So it's not the complete letters by any means. They are formed by me to my ends in telling the story.
Did you have any idea to what extent the play would take off and be performed by so many different people?
Absolutely not. The first time, which I thought it was going to be the only time we performed the play, it was the reaction afterward that made me think that perhaps we could push it along a little. Ed Asner played the part of what was then the narrator, and Steve Martin read the letters of my father, so he essentially became the character. And we had no rehearsal, just 20 minutes to make sure that everybody could find their way on stage, and then put it on cold.
And it brought the house down.
Actually, they rose to their feet.
So then how did the movie come to be made, the one that is screening now at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe?
The movie is the inspiration of Peter Askin, who directed it. And Peter Askin was the director of the play in New York. He and I worked very closely on the play there, and he had the idea that this was a story that needed to be told in another way and made more generally available. And so the documentary was his idea.
Well, it's a wonderful documentary and a very important one. When you look at the time that we're living in now, do you see parallels to the Hollywood blacklist?
Well, to an extent. Yeah, nothing is ever the same. Things come back in a different guise. There were certainly at the beginnings of the Iraq War hints by people who on radio and television that people who opposed the war that were actors and singers and people who are entertainers, and that they should be blacklisted. You know, just don't buy their stuff. Boycott them. In response to that, the Screen Actors Guild made a public declaration that there will not be another blacklist in Hollywood. But an example of the tenor of the times as a parallel is the reaction to the Dixie Chicks, when suddenly people started tromping on their DVDs and declaring them to be people you shouldn't listen to. So they reinvented themselves, and in a sense, their lives will never be the same.
Christopher Trumbo, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
You're welcome.